We'll give you one. If you half raise your hand, you're going to get one too. Okay. With those preliminary remarks made, let me introduce the court. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. I think you met with him at the lunch hour. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rogenstock. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. And to her right, Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, Justice Annette Siegler. With those comments made, we will now ask Thomas Schnick to take the podium, and he represents Ellen Topolsky. I shall return in a few moments.
May proceed.
Good afternoon, Justices. My name is Thomas Schneck, and I represent the petitioner in this matter, Ellen Topolsky. Although I don't want to bore you with the facts of this case, I do think there are some facts that are pertinent to the discussions and the arguments involved. Back in 1995, Patrick and Ellen Topolsky were divorced after a 24-year marriage. That marriage produced three children, one of which was a minor at the time of the divorce, and there were two significant assets that were divided by the terms of their divorce agreement. One was a homestead, which had approximately $110,000 in equity and required Patrick to pay Ellen $55,000 in increments, $40,000 at the beginning and $15,000 later on. In addition to the homestead that was divided, the parties also divided Patrick's electrical construction industry pension plan. The terms of the divorce agreement required Patrick to pay Ellen $912.88 per month when and if he received those benefits. And that, Your Honors, is the crux of this matter before the court and why this matter has weaved its way through the Wisconsin judicial system. Prior to filing her motion in 2008, Ellen Topolsky was not paid the sums that were due her relative to the property division as it related to the homestead equity. Also, Ellen Topolsky had not received $912.88 per month from Patrick when Patrick began receiving those benefits in December of 2001. Ellen Topolsky did not know that Patrick was receiving those benefits until 2008 and filed her motion, shortly thereafter. At the time of the divorce, there was a provision in the judgment which allowed Ellen to receive a qualified domestic relations order if Patrick did not voluntarily pay the $912.88 per month. Ellen's motion was to hold Patrick in contempt for his failure to pay Ellen the property division as it related to the home. It asked for Patrick to be held in contempt for his failure to pay her $912.88 per month as a result of his receipt of benefits, and it requested that a qualified domestic relations order be implemented relative to the continuing payments of the $912.88.
Counsel, let me ask you a couple of things that are sort of troubling to me. It's been a long time since I was on the circuit bench, but I still have a pretty good memory that most of the time in regard to pensions, they're handled by a Cudrill, and that wasn't done here. Also, it's interesting to me that the figure of $912.88 is not exactly a rounded figure. Is there anything in the record that shows why there wasn't a Cudrill and why that unusual dollar figure was selected?
Your Honor, I can answer the latter question first, and I'll get back to the first question second. The number of $912.88 is unclear from the record. When I asked both parties during the hearing in 2009 on the contempt motion, what their recollection was as to how that figure was obtained. Neither one of them could answer the question. During the discovery process, it was unclear to me why that figure was used. I can only surmise, Your Honor, that a valuation was done at the time of the divorce, which set the amount of the benefits that he was to receive at the time of the divorce, and it was halved. That would be the only thing that I could surmise that occurred. As a result of the qualified domestic relations order not being immediately implemented, that is also troubling to me as well as a practicing family law attorney. I don't know of a situation in which I would ever recommend to a client, nor if I had a client who was obligated to pay pension benefits, that we would not have insisted on a qualified domestic relations order being done. It is the surest, safest, and most secure way to divide those pension benefits. Why they chose to do it in this case, again, is unclear from the record. Neither party was able to testify at the time of the hearing as to why that wasn't done. When you're dealing with pension benefits as a general rule, there are generally two ways to divide those pension benefits. Those pension divisions are set forth in Bloomer versus Bloomer, cited at 84 West 2nd 124, 267 Northwest 2nd 235. It's a 1978 case. Essentially, you can divide up pension benefits in two manners. One, you can calculate the present value of the pension, and you can pay it in a lump sum or pay it off in increments. The other way to divide it is to determine a fixed percentage or payment if and when received. In the Topolsky case, the parties chose the second methodology. And I think that's important because they could have chosen the first methodology to divide up this pension. They could have set a present value of that pension. Mr. Topolsky could have bought out Mrs. Topolsky's interest in that pension, and we wouldn't be here today. Nonetheless, they chose the second methodology. Why are pension benefits divided pursuant to a divorce? Well, that's clearly elicited in the Wall case, Wong versus Wong, W-A-L-N, 2005, WSAP 54. States, pension benefits divided effectuates the policy that each spouse makes a valuable contribution to the marriage and that each spouse should be compensated for that contribution. An interest in a pension plan is part of that wealth.
Okay. We agree that the pension plan was part of the property settlement, not part of maintenance, right?
Correct.
And we agree that the parties agreed that the property settlement was a payment of $900 and some per month. That was the valuation in effect, right? Okay. For as long as he lived.
Correct.
As long as he received the pension. And if he died and the pension didn't come into effect, she got nothing.
Correct.
Because he got nothing.
Correct.
Right. Okay. Now, do we also agree that as I read this pension plan, it's 162, that the disability pension here is what the normal pension amount would be?
That is correct.
Right? So he's getting the $2,000 plus early, right?
He gets it when he qualifies for it, yes.
And he qualified it by becoming disabled.
Correct.
And that when he gets to be normal retirement age, whatever it is, 62 or 65, he gets the same amount that he would have gotten had he not taken disability.
That's correct. However, if I might, I think this is important, there is no conversion to a service pension at that point in time, meaning that when he turns age 62, he doesn't now get a retirement pension. He gets the disability pension for as long as
he lives.
That's
because they are one and the same, equal in amount, I understand this plan.
That is correct.
But if he had retired at 62, she would then be entitled to the $900 per month.
If he did not receive any benefits until age 62, that's when she would begin receiving the 91288, if he started to receive them. If he never requested a pension, if he never received any benefits, whether at 62 or at 65, she wouldn't get anything either.
That's right, because it's dealed if and it's was if and when.
Correct.
Okay. Now, if he had worked instead of becoming disabled and had earned the same amount as income, right?
Right.
How much would she get of it?
Because she was not exercising the pension benefits, she wouldn't get anything.
That's right. So tell me why she should get it now, because what he is getting is a substitute for his income, isn't he?
Well, not necessarily, Your Honor. Isn't retirement itself a substitute for income? When we retire, we get income that replaces that income that we would have had we continued to work.
Sure, and we get dividend income and we get interest income, too. But retirement income may or may not be a substitute for your income. It could be in excess of your income. It could be less than your income. It may or may not vest. The company may go out of business. But the concept is that there would be an amount that's paid.
Right. And to answer...
If you press too hard on what you just said, then she should be entitled to nothing if it's a substitute for income. Because under this plan, that is the settlement agreement, she was to get nothing out of income. She's only to get a division of property. So they view, and the whole concept of pension is to view a pension not as income, but as a property.
All that was the first part of my argument. The second part of my argument, Your Honor, is that this isn't replacement income. This is an asset that was divided. It was funded, as all deferred compensation plans are, from the employer's deferring income that would have been enjoyed during the marriage.
I have another question for you then. The value of this asset would have been much higher if he were entitled to the benefits before 62.
Yes.
That's right. And therefore, she would have gotten more than $900.
Correct.
But now, she's entitled to $900 only for the value of the assets from age 62 until death. That's how they valued it.
I don't know that that's correct, Your Honor. I don't think that that's true. In the record, there was no evidence to suggest how it was valued.
And you think that would be a normal way of valuing.
Yes, I agree. That would be a normal way. But I don't know whether it was valued at age 55, and that's where they came up with the 912. I don't know if they valued it at age 65. I don't know how they valued it at that point in time.
Counselor, this is the same electrical construction industry pension plan that Mr. Topolsky had at the time of divorce, correct?
So, yes.
And the circuit court made a finding where he said, in December of 2001, the petitioner commenced receiving benefits under his pension from the electrical construction industry plan. Is that a finding of fact or a conclusion of law? He lists it as a finding.
I believe it was a finding that he received pension benefits from that plan in December 2001.
Okay. Thank you.
Is the transcript of the MSA being put on the record in the closed file here? Is it anywhere in the file, the transcript of the questions that were asked, the answers that were given, the judge going through the MSA?
At the divorce hearing?
Right.
No, there is not.
Who drafted the marital settlement agreement?
I believe it was counsel for the husband, Patrick Topolsky, but I'm not positive of that. That would be the normal practice in the community for the petitioner to draft the marital settlement agreement and also to draft the findings of facts, conclusions of law, but there is no affirmative statement one way or the other that that was in fact done by petitioner's counsel at the time of the divorce.
And the electrical construction industry pension plan, this is, there's a date on that, December 2007.
Correct. That was the plan that was provided to us by the union relative to the discussion of this. My understanding is that other than the formula for how service credits are compiled, the document is the same as it was at the time Mr. Topolsky and Mrs. Topolsky were divorced and at the time Mr. Topolsky started receiving benefits.
But there's no nothing in the record of what this plan said in, when was it, 1995 when they were divorced?
No, there's nothing in the record.
We just are supposed to assume that they're exactly the same?
Yes. I don't know what else how else to answer that question other than to say yes, that you can assume that. That issue has not been raised by either side, that the pension plan that we are interpreting from 2007 is different than the pension plan that was involved in 1995, nor in 2001 when benefits started to be received.
Is this for the whole industry, or what's the scope of this plan?
The scope of the plan, the electrical construction industry pension plan, is the electrical construction industry as a whole. Any union shop that's covered under the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers is covered under this plan. It's essentially an IBEW plan.
Was there anything else that could have been divided by Quadro?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
Was there anything else that could have been divided by Quadro?
Well, when you say anything else, I'm assuming what you mean by that was there a way to divide the pension via Quadro at the time of the divorce? There would have been. I don't know why they didn't immediately do a Quadro.
But could this document be referring to anything other than the account that now is the subject of this dispute?
No. There was the only pension and profit-sharing deferred benefit plans that were in existence at the time of the divorce was the electrical construction industry pension plan. So that the reference in the marital settlement agreement was only to that plan. There was no other plan out there that this could have been referring to, nor were there any other pension or retirement benefits at issue.
Was there any testimony about who is entitled to receive a copy of the industry plan? I mean, do all the people who are subject to it get copies of it?
I think if you request it, you certainly can, and as an interested party, Ellen Topolsky would have been entitled to a copy. When I was contacted by Ms. Topolsky to put forth this motion, Mr. Topolsky signed an authorization that allowed me to get a copy of the summary plan description from the pension itself, and that's how I got it at first. And that would be typically within the industry that's how you would do that. I think if Ellen Topolsky, as a intended beneficiary of that, if she had requested it, she probably would be provided that as well.
If memory serves me correctly, your opposing counsel said something to the effect that disability benefits were never discussed at the time the marital settlement agreement was negotiated. Any response to that?
There's nothing in the record to suggest that disability benefits as a concept were discussed. I think that cuts both ways. When you look at a pension plan like this, and it's typical of a union industry pension plan, you will have disability provisions within those plans. What the parties did was they divided up the benefits that were achieved to date, and that's reflected in the $912.88 per month. And in my opinion, the discussion of whether there was disability contemplated or not contemplated, it could have been brought up. It could have been discussed. It wasn't discussed. I don't know that then, therefore, you can get a reopening or a revision of the divorce agreement on things that you maybe or should have discussed at the time of the divorce. And I would point to the Winkler case that I cited in my brief, Winkler versus Winkler, 2005, Wisconsin Court of Appeals 100. Pension changes don't support modifications in the divorce judgment, meaning that when a pension plan itself changes its rules, it doesn't allow the litigants to come back to court and revise or modify their divorce judgment. And so in this case, I would think that the same rule holds, that if they didn't discuss concepts like disability or other things that, you know, could have been discussed and they didn't, you can't come back later on and say, well, we should have discussed those. We didn't. I mean, they could have valued the plan and divided it in half, and he could have paid her half the value. They could have contemplated, and I think having now been involved in this case, it is certainly a practice tip that I have picked up on, is that when discussing divisions of pension plans that have a disability option, you may want to discuss those aspects to protect your client's interests going one way or the other. I think it's just prudent now, given the dispute that has arisen here.
Well, Counselor, there is a part in this plan, which is, of course, one thing we have to reconcile with the stipulation, on page 2, where it defines retirement. And it says, the period after you qualify for a pension under the plan and start to receive monthly pension payments is considered retirement. It doesn't condition it on not being disability or being early or late. And then on page 12, it talks about what types of pensions are provided in the pension plan. And it lists three types: all pensions, a normal pension for one who's 65, an early pension, someone who's at least 55 but not yet 65, and a disability pension. So, I mean, when I read retirement and I see three different types of pensions that are provided in retirement, and getting a pension is how retirement is defined, I mean, I don't see exactly how we got to where we got today, to be quite honest with you.
Well, Your Honor, I did point that out in my reply brief to this court, that retirement is in fact defined by the pension plan itself as the time period when one starts to receive benefits, regardless of what they are.
And I know the Court of Appeals said, well, you get the benefits at retirement when you reach retirement age, but there's nothing in the stipulation that says that.
I agree.
It says if and when.
I agree.
So you can get them at 55, you get them at 65, you can get them at 57 and a half. I suppose if you're disabled, I don't know, is there a limit on disability? I don't know, maybe you can get them earlier. He is permanently and totally disabled, though, so he's never going to get well.
That's my understanding.
Right.
And it does say in the plan itself that the only requirement when receiving a disability pension is that you are subject to at least, I think, a medical exam once every 2 years.
Yeah.
In order to continue to qualify. That goes for life. I mean, even after 65.
Yeah, that's what it says for the lifetime of the right. Of the pension.
Thank you.
Well, I have. Go ahead.
I am not quite sure what I should rely on in trying to decide this case. Should I rely on anything more than the divorce judgment and the marital settlement agreement?
I think that's a difficult question to answer, but I will answer it this way. In part, yes. The parties had an agreement. They divided up an asset. And in that respect, that agreement is final, and it should be respected by the courts. And when one party doesn't adhere to those provisions, they should be brought to the court and brought to task for the failure to do that. I understand the nature of the dispute here, and I understand the controversy that was created in this situation. And I would simply say that the overriding concern here is what they agreed to in their divorce, not what occurred later. I pointed out that this is no different to me than Patrick saying, I'm not going to pay you your share of the home equity because I am disabled. I now need that money for me, for my disability. An asset like that is property. It was divided, and you cannot convert it to a disability. What you are doing, if you deny Ellen her right to receive the $912, is you are, in effect, forcing her to pay Patrick maintenance. She was given that asset when he received it. And now by denying it to her, she is, in effect, subsidizing Patrick to the tune of $912. That's maintenance, and maintenance was denied by these two people. If they had held it open, there would be an argument that could be made by Patrick. There could be an argument that was made by Ellen. But, in fact, by denying maintenance, she is, in effect, by virtue of the Court of Appeals decision, subsidizing Patrick.
Is there not something troubling about the finding of contempt here? You've got a situation where the man, as I understand it, has a series of strokes. That occurs, and he starts getting disability in 2001. In 2008, she brings this matter to the court. The court makes a decision in 2009, finds that he's in contempt. Three judges on the Court of Appeals found the opposite way. We're here before the Wisconsin Supreme Court because we've got questions about, was this disability? Was this retirement benefits? What was it? And yet he's found in contempt. The judge goes all the way back to 2001, $89,000 plus, 12% interest, as I understand it. Isn't that a little bit troubling? It's troubling to me. Isn't that troubling legitimately to the court?
I am not troubled by it.
I wouldn't expect you to be.
I'm not troubled by it because Patrick was in control. He could have notified Ellen in 2001 that he started receiving these benefits. He could have, if he felt that these were exempt from the property division, he could have filed a motion before the court and said, I'm now disabled, I'm now receiving this, I don't want to share this with her. He could have done that. He was silent for 7 years until she got an inkling that this was going on and the motion was filed. So I'm not troubled at all by the finding of contempt because he was in control of notifying Ellen. If there was an automatic qualified domestic relations order, again, a practice tip that I think most attorneys would have insisted on, then this wouldn't have been that problematic. It was the willingness to allow Patrick to be in control, which is the double-edged sword that he now faces. He was in control, and he didn't follow through. Thank you.
Now, what was appealed? I'm sorry, when you sought review, I'm looking to see if I have that material with me. When you sought review, what was the issue you sought review on?
Your Honor, the Court of Appeals determined that Patrick was entitled to keep that pension until age 65, that Ellen Topolsky was not entitled to the benefits because the parties contemplated that he wouldn't be able to receive this until age 65. That was the holding in the Court of Appeals. That was the issue.
Yeah, so the Court of Appeals said no contempt. You didn't seek review of that.
What the Court of Appeals argued, Your Honor, was that there was no duty for Patrick to pay these, hence there was no contempt. The circumstances of Judge Kiefer's decision regarding the methodology for repayment and the purge orders was never addressed in the Court of Appeals, wasn't raised throughout this process.
Your statement of the issue is whether Patrick's receipt of benefits required him to pay $912 to Ellen. It didn't seem to raise the issues about contempt. That's the only issue you raised. Is contempt before us?
If
you haven't briefed it.
If Ellen was entitled to receive $912.88 when Patrick received them, then in fact Patrick's failure to pay them was a violation of the court order.
Yeah, but the judge needn't have found contempt, needn't have found retroactive payment.
Because the contempt began in December of 2001 when Patrick failed to pay the $912.88.
I don't know whether there's a defense, and I'm not trying to argue a defense. All I'm trying to do is raise an appellate issue. And the appellate issue is that if you don't present an issue for us to review, we don't review it. And as I read your brief, the only issue you deal with is the $912 and not the contempt, although your conclusion is to reaffirm the judgment and order of the circuit court totally. So I'm just raising that as an issue.
Yeah, fair enough.
I don't think the Court of Appeals addressed contempt either.
I would argue it did not.
Right.
Well, we don't have to debate it. We can just say, look at the order of the circuit court, which is at page 104. Consequently, we reverse the finding of contempt. We vacate the determination that Ellen is entitled to immediate implementation. We reverse the award of $83,000 plus interest as arrears. We reverse the award of attorney fees, and we vacate the requirement that Patrick execute a mortgage in favor of Ellen. That's what they say they did. So I don't, you know, I only know what I read.
I read the same thing.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Joseph F. Owens, representing Patrick Topolsky.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Let me pull this a little closer. Students, counsel, clerks.
We've covered everybody.
I think so. Well, Mr. Marshall.
Deputy Marshall.
Deputy Marshall. Thank you, Your Honor. I think that one of the issues that haven't been addressed, and this is an interesting case, I think Justice Prosser puts his finger on it, first of all, by saying, what should I look at? In 1995, when these people get divorced, this pension plan that we were given, we don't know if that was what the provisions were then. The language of the MSA, which you have on quoted on page 8 of the brief filed by Ellen in the court, it says all retirement, on top of page 8, sub F, quoting from the MSA, all retirement, pension, and deferred benefit accounts in his name.
Where's the deferred benefit account?
On the top of page 8 of the brief.
I know, I've got it. I'm saying, where is it in the plan?
I don't think there is one. In other words, these people are in their middle 40s or early 40s. They are talking about a future. We don't know if Patrick is going to continue working at Miller Brewing Company, or is he going to go somewhere else? He's an electrician. So what pensions he may have in the future are being addressed generically. And at the time, it was this pension plan, but we don't know what the future is going to hold. We also know that Layton was the law at the time, and we also know that Duffy was a case out of District 4. Judge P. Charles Jones had addressed that case. And Judge Ike had written for the Court of Appeals in a Wisconsin retirement system case that the law is that disability pension or payments are not subject to division. That is what the lawyers at the time in 1994 would have known. That's what the parties would be imputed to know, the law prevailing at the time. The word retirement is defined, as Justice Rogensack points out, in this plan, which we are given a copy of in 2007, a certain way.
So, Mr. Owens, let me just
cut to the chase. Do you agree or disagree that this plan and the language in this plan from 2005 or whatever is the same language that was in place in the plan that was discussed in the 95 MSA?
I can't say that, Your Honor.
Okay. So you are not stipulating that we can use the definitions and the language of this 2005 plan?
In interpreting a 94-95 document, no, I do not.
Okay.
I
needed to know that.
That's correct.
But did you object to that document?
No, I stipulated to it being in place in 2001 when payments started. That was the plan in effect. This 07 language was the same as it was in 01 when he started getting payments, which would have triggered his obligation to give money, if at all. But not, I have no, and it wasn't my burden at the hearing to provide that in evidence. It was a moving party to find my client in contempt. So the burden of proof would have been upon the person asserting the affirmative in that case. So we were not addressing what it was in 94.
Did you ever raise the issue that it might have been different?
No.
No.
No, I did not. No. And I think that the point is we need to look at the law. The law we have, and the law is Leighton, and everyone would have been relying on Leighton, and we are going to upset Leighton and all the cases following Leighton if we now rule that disability benefits are not replacement for income and a part of the maintenance or alimony issue rather than property division, incipient property division, unknown property division, but property division. That will be a change in the law.
Your opposing counsel had an expert witness, isn't that right?
Yes.
And when the expert witness testified, what was the expert witness relying on?
He was relying on this plan, but he was giving opinions that turned into legal opinions. Okay.
The plan in this appendix?
Yes, Your Honor. His testimony is in the transcript in the appendix.
Okay. You said you stipulated that this document in the appendix would have applied as of 2001?
Yes.
But the document says that it might not apply for people who weren't making contributions before December 31st, 2006.
It might not, but that was the provisions of the plan that we stipulated to, Your Honor. We said that was the operative document. His expert testified that that was the operative document, and I accepted that. I stipulated to that. Now, in retrospect, should I have gone back and required this expert to prove his accuracy? Perhaps I should have. I took him at his word. He was supposedly an expert. But, again, he can't make legal conclusions, which is what he did. He made a legal conclusion that a disability pension is subject to property division in a divorce. And that's a legal conclusion that can't be done. There's a fact here, too, that I want to bring out. Because the troubling issue is, in other cases, when these people with military pensions or VA benefit pensions have a choice that they are now eligible for in-pay status, and they have a choice of either choosing a disability or choosing an early retirement, and they choose the disability, which has the effect of A, having it not be taxable, and B, not subject to the wife's claim. Why doesn't that apply here? I wrestled like, well, why wouldn't that apply here? And the answer is because at the time that Patrick began receiving benefits, he could not make that election. He was only 53 years old. The findings of fact conclusions of law show him to be born on December 18th of the year 1948. He would not be age 55, which is the earliest age under the plan you can get early retirement until the year 2003. So in 2001, when he becomes disabled by his third stroke, he's only 53 years old. He cannot elect early retirement. He cannot use this election to perhaps make non-taxable benefits or dissolve any obligation of his wife. The only thing he can elect is disability. So that's the distinction between all of the other cases cited where the courts have said, if you have this election right, we are going to count that, even if you did select disability, those dollars are going to be brought into the marital estate subject to division. In this Duffy case, which did not come up in the Court of Appeals, did not come up in our briefing, and was just discovered yesterday, and I can't explain why. It's not in Westlaw under the right catchphrases, but it's the Duffy case.
Also, what's the site?
Yes, Your Honor. Before oral argument, I shared it with counsel, and I shared it with the clerks. The site is 132 Wissecond, 340.
122?
132.
Okay.
Wissecond.
340.
Thank you very much.
And that was a case in which Judge P. Charles Jones had to deal with the Wisconsin retirement system, and a man was disabled, and he elected to get his disability through WRS, the monthly benefit, and then subsequently was divorced by his wife. And the decision affirmed by Judge Ike in the Court of Appeals, writing the opinion in 86, was that that portion of the benefits paid to him prior to his earliest retirement age of 65 would be maintenance type, subject to maintenance analysis, income replacement. And then after reaching the retirement age would be property division, and she would receive her benefits from that. That, I think, is what the Court of Appeals exactly did in our case, without citing it, not even apparently or being aware of the case. So I think that that analysis has, first of all, on a common sense basis, makes sense. And whether this court or the Court of Appeals chooses age 62, which was the earliest point at which a person could get full benefits under this plan, or age 65, those two make sense to me, because those would have been dates that would have been benchmarks in the minds of the common people and the court. Age 62 and age 65 are two dates that are used in many, many plans for early retirement or full retirement. So I believe that the Court of Appeals decision, waiting until age 65, is certainly the most strict application of Layton. Age 62 would have been this past summer, based on Patrick's birth date, and he even stated in the trial court he had no problem with that if the court had said start paying age 62. But this reach back idea of going back 7 or 8 years and then charging 12% interest and attorney's fees, he's going to become a homeless man. He has no money to do this but to sell the house. It's extremely harsh. And one gets into the question of the doctrine of latches here. While Mrs. testified that she didn't really know Patrick was disabled, it's kind of hard. And Patrick couldn't testify that she definitely knew. They didn't have a lot of contact. But their kids went back and forth almost every week. And the children didn't want to come and testify against their parents, as you can imagine. No one wanted that. The bottom line being, waiting 7 years to bring a motion, I would submit that the earliest date would have been the date of the motion that relief should date from, as is typical in child support revision and alimony maintenance revision. So if someone's going to claim that they are getting some money or do some money, it should be as of the date of the motion rather than an automatic retroactivity, unless there was a filing of contempt and an intentional violation of a court order, which I think Justice Crooks has pointed out is very difficult to perceive in this case. So I think there are some options that the court has in terms of looking at what in all divorces the courts of equity should do, and we are sitting as a court of equity here, in chancery, if you will. So the merger of law and equity has led that to this point. We are here to do justice.
What rule of law is to come out of this case?
I believe that the Layton rule should be applied, that disability benefits should always be identified as not property division, as Layton did, as Duffy did, and that if there is an election, with caveat, if there is an election that a person can make They are in pay status. They are eligible. If they can make an election to go either way, then the elector cannot choose a way that disadvantages the electee, shall we say, the other spouse.
Also, if we chose that route, then every spouse who didn't have a pension and had a lawyer who read our opinions, which we hope they do, would always value the pension on the date of divorce and make the owning spouse pay the present value. Because you never know if someone's going to get disabled and they have a pension like this where you think you'll get it when he gets it, but then you say, well, maybe you'll get it, but maybe you won't get it. Well, if you get that maybe you won't, seems better to have a bird in the hand than one in the bush that you may never catch up to. Right?
Does, Your Honor, I believe that getting a quadro would be the answer. As everyone has said, why wouldn't we do a quadro?
If you got a QDRO on this, you'd be making the same argument. The man is still disabled. Just say she learned about it 3 years ago. And if she had a QDRO, she'd get paid from the very day he got it, which was before he was 55.
The plan administrator would have had to make a determination. In fact, they are waiting for your determination right now.
And I can understand that. But I mean, but if the law is that you can't divide a disability and the man gets a pension because of disability, QD or no QDRO, somebody's lawyer is going to come to court and say, well, we had a QDRO, but it can't be applied to these payments because they're disability. So I don't think that will solve the problem. I think what we would encourage is that everybody values the pension on the date of divorce, and if it's not your pension, you take your half and take a walk. At least you know you got that half.
In
this case, this man could die tomorrow and she would have gotten zero.
That's
absolutely
correct.
Nothing.
It's true. I agree. And
after 24 years of marriage.
True, but they made a decision not to use a quadro initially. That was a decision that she made. She certainly was entitled to it. And she was entitled to come in and seek a quadro as soon as she wanted to, if she felt he was not paying it.
I think sometimes they don't get a QDRO because there's a little bit of control that's going on there, and the spouse may not like someone having anything controlling over their assets, though usually it's more customary than not.
Well, if there was a QDRO, to follow that up, and if the law is that you don't get a quadro of the disability benefits,
right.
I don't think that the plan administrator has a problem. You're saying because they have already created the separate alternative payee account at the time of the divorce, they would have created that account and funded it. Would have been.
I understand.
And then no growth would have occurred if a disability later occurred because it's only the alternate payee's account that is there. So I'm not sure that it really, I'm not sure.
You don't think it would undermine that kind of approach?
I don't think so. And I know that Greg Herman for the family law section wrote a commentary about this case when you granted the petition, and some of them have seen it, that he's saying, why was there no quadro that would have solved this problem? I think he's right, but I'm not sure.
Well, if a quadro would have permitted her to have payments from the date he received them, why should we choose anything different just because there wasn't a quadro? I mean, the payments are the same payments. They're disability payments all day, if that's how you're going to characterize them. I mean, either it's a pension that they agreed to divide or it's not. And I think what you're saying to me, it's not. Well, if it's not, then I don't see how having a QDRO is going to solve the problem because it wouldn't be what they agreed to divide.
Well, I think that the pension plan administrator would have created two accounts on the day of the quadro being placed.
Sure, I understand that. But then,
and then if a disability occurred later, that would only affect his account, so to speak, and hers would be what it would be.
But he's always the marker, unless this is an unusual plan. You usually get payments under a QDRO when the beneficiary is eligible for payments. So sometimes you may have a spouse that's 10 years older than her husband. She gets a QDRO. She can't collect until he can collect.
I don't think that's correct. Can't you have a situation where there's authorization to withdraw from your portion of the QDRO? I'm thinking
you're correct, Your Honor, if I understand your question. I'm not sure I got your question.
Well, I don't think you necessarily, on your portion, let's say I'm the wife, I'm awarded my portion of the pension plan. Not in every situation is it that you have to wait until
right.
your husband starts drawing.
Correct.
You have a separate fund, and it may very well be you can withdraw money from that fund during
before the eligibility of the designated. That
I would be
depends on the plan.
Yes, it does.
It's in the plan.
But it's not just you get the payment when.
So, and I also think, Justice Roggensack, that it might have been a lesser sum had there been a immediate quadro. That $912.88 a month may have been a lesser sum if that was if that number was accumulated based on projections that didn't occur because he goes into disability and pay status. So, and I don't know the answer to that.
Well, he gets the same thing I thought you told us in disability pay status as he does as a regular retiree. I thought that was
true. Well, that is true. That is true. You do. You get it as the same. So I guess that would have been whatever the quadro would have paid, it would have paid.
Yeah.
Well, but your argument, if I understood it, is that this language, all retirement pension and deferred benefit accounts, doesn't say the electrical union.
No.
It doesn't say your present retirement pension and deferred benefit. It could, if he had changed jobs and he had some vested interest in this plan and had a new plan, it would have covered everything.
Right.
Is that right?
Started up a new business on his own as a self-employed?
Would have covered everything. Right? Because there's no deferred benefit account, as I read this. No.
No.
No, it's a long plan, and it's could have missed it, but I didn't see any.
So,
you don't know where the $912.88 came from?
I do not at this moment. No, I can't. It was a negotiated sum between the parties. How it was arrived at.
And it's not in the record. I don't know whether you know it or you don't know it. So. Generic statement.
It's a generic statement. And the key, I think, is that the word is retirement in F, which I don't think normal people would agree that retirement would include disability.
Well,
retirement
what about
means
pension?
Something different.
What about pension? Do you refer to pension as disability?
I think that if the word retirement is modifying pension, that is a meaning completely different than disability. I think those are separate things to the general population. And I think, borne out in Layton and in Duffy, the courts draw a distinction between a retirement word benefit and a disability pension benefit. They make the distinction, and the bench and the bar have made those distinctions since the 70s based on Layton.
Did they make a distinction between disability benefit or disability pension benefit? I mean, I think it's black letter law that disability benefit is income replacement.
The cases that are in the briefs, and then include Duffy, they are pension cases. Mm-hmm. They're not disability insurance cases, which is a different animal, I believe.
Wahlberg is
Mr. Rollins and Mr. Schenck, when you have a chance, here's my main concern. The last thing we should do as a court is mess up the law and the practice of law that's currently happening at the lower court level based upon an agreement that may not be clear between two specific parties. So I would like each of your best suggestions on how this court does not mess up the law.
Your Honor, and I think I answered this before, I think Justice Bradley asked me, what should be the ruling here? The ruling should be that disability benefits that are triggered by disability are income replacement. They are relevant for alimony or maintenance and consideration. They are not part of property division until such time as a person becomes eligible for early retirement or regular retirement. And I think that's the answer. The third refinement is if you have one of those situations like in the military and the VA cases where a person can choose one or the other, it's the same amount of money, but one is designated as disability, one is designated as a retirement pension, and I think we're going to see those with the Afghanistan war and the Iraq war, that the election cannot disenfranchise the spouse if the person is at the time in pay status eligible for both of them, then I think it should be property division. One person should not be able to elect to disenfranchise the spouse.
Isn't your rule really contemplating that we decide this case on something other than the documents in front of us?
No, I don't think so. I think that if we were going to go back to 1994 and if we're going to apply the law in place at the time, and as it sits right now, the law as it applies right now, unless we change it, we take the document in court and the law as it stands and apply it. And we have to look to an extrinsic source, such as a pension plan, to find something different than that. And it was not specifically incorporated by reference in a corporate sense. We're incorporating by reference this specific pension plan was not. And as Chief Justice points out, this man could have started his own business or gone to another employer, not been subject to this plan. So how can we say that their 94 divorce incorporated specifically extrinsic documents that aren't referred to? I don't think so. We have to look at the language of the case at the circuit court level, and we have to look at the appellate decision law.
In terms of the marital settlement agreement, do you agree with the opposing counsel's interpretation of the if and when clause?
I do not, because I don't think it can be separated from the modifier retirement. And I don't think that the word retirement means anything like disability. I believe those are separate concepts in the law. If and when is irrelevant.
If the man had not suffered the strokes and kept on working,
right,
you're saying that his former wife would have been entitled to pension benefits at age?
Earliest age 62, and it did say if and when he accepted. The earliest you could get it would be age 62. If he elected, whenever he began receiving. That's what it said.
Well, but he didn't begin receiving if he kept on. If he wouldn't have begun receiving, true, if he kept on working.
That's correct. I don't disagree with that.
But it seems to me if the plan is not triggered until he starts collecting under the language, it seems to me it is triggered when he does start collecting.
Yes, but it must be a retirement benefit that he's collecting.
Well, but that doesn't seem to me to be a clear distinction based on the document.
Which document?
The document that you stipulated to, at least beginning as of 2001.
Well, that document was the plan, but not in place at the time of the divorce. And I don't think that it was incorporated by reference.
Don't you have to look at both? You've got a divorce agreement here. And that is your governing document. And it doesn't refer to any specific document. It doesn't refer to any specific retirement pension or deferred benefit account, right?
Correct.
But the goal appears to be, I mean, isn't this how you have to analyze it? The goal appears to be that on retirement, this is a property, right? At the time of divorce, these retirement pension deferred is a property. It is valued in this stipulation. And it is valued that she will get $912 for life once he starts collecting as a property.
Correct.
Issue. Okay. Now he's disabled, and now we have an exact document that deals with retirement pension and deferred benefit, right? And the goal was to give her a value of the property. The issue before the court is, are these early payouts before 62, let's just take the easiest, earliest, are they more like compensation, replacement for compensation? Because if he were working and he was getting $2,000 plus a month, she gets nothing. And in this plan, she gets this $2,000, and it does not diminish his retirement, right? At 62, he gets exactly what he would get if he were not disabled. Not a dime more, not a dime less. So the question is, this preceding, now, it would be different, it seems to me, if this agreement that we're working under, this retirement plan, if he got disability payments and they diminished what he got at 62 or 65, if they diminished it, then that's eating into her property. And you can argue this. If it doesn't diminish what she ultimately gets, you can argue that that is replacement income. I mean, don't you have to analyze what was intended by the stipulation and how does that fit with the actual payments he's getting? I would view this case very differently if he got reduced benefits at 62 or 65, but he gets exactly the same. This plan could have provided he gets only $1,000 disability, and then when he gets to be 62, he gets $2,000, right?
Right.
Or he gets $2,000 now, and he gets a every 5 years he gets less.
Right.
I mean, the plan could have provided any number of things.
Right.
And don't we have to analyze both what was intended by the marriage, divorce, I should say, stipulation, and what is the plan doing?
I think in that sense, yes.
So where do you come out? I know you come out for your client.
You know,
okay, got that. I dig that.
Counselor, do you agree with opposing counsel that when Mr. Topolsky achieves the age of 65, the plan doesn't then kick over to a regular 65-year-old retirement plan?
It apparently does not.
It does not. Okay, thank you.
Apparently does not. My time is up. Thank you, Your Honors.
There was no objection to Mr. Owens handing out the case that he handed out, counsel?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Schneck?
Thank you, Your Honors, for one last opportunity. With regard to the Duffy case cited by Mr. Owens, there are some distinctions that need to be made between that case and this case. And the two important distinctions, and I'll try to wrap this all together to respond to Justice Ziegler's request, is as follows. One, in Duffy, he was already in pay status at the time the divorce judgment was done, and that means that he was receiving the disability portion of the pension at the time of the divorce. And so the court, I believe, opined, my reading of it was, that it was going to be treated as income for that period of time. There was a requirement in the Wisconsin retirement plan in Duffy that's not present in this case. In Duffy, a person was subject to medical examinations until age 65, and at that point in time, there was no longer any requirement for medical examinations. And I think that that's an important distinction from the case at hand because in Topolsky, those are required lifetime. If you look at the summary plan description, there is no cessation of those medical exam requirements. Now, that may allow Mr. Topolsky to convert, I guess, to a retirement plan under those terms. But in Duffy, the court utilized that factor to determine that at age 65, when those when those medical exams were no longer required, that then he would be receiving retirement benefits, not disability benefits. And I think that's an important distinction. Justice Ziegler asked, what's the rule of, or Justice Bradley and Justice Ziegler both asked, what's the rule of law? And I think this is the rule of law. You have to look at the nature of the disability payments. In Layton, they were VA disability payments. In Kronforst, they were Social Security disability payments. when you look to the source of the funds that creates the stream of payments, that's your clue. In Topolsky and in some other cases, the source of funds is the marital contributions. These are deferred benefits. They are not paid as a result of a condition like VA benefits, which get paid when you are a veteran and become disabled in the line of duty, or that are service-connected, or Social Security disability benefits that get paid when you achieve a disability finding. These are deferred benefits. They are, in fact, the source's marital contributions under the holding in Wong. That's the avenue that you have to look at. So the rule is that when determining whether to treat disability benefits as income only and not subject to division, or disability benefits as dividable in a marital situation, you look at where the source of the funds was. In this case, they were deferred payments, meaning that had there not been a deferred plan in place, had the employers of the construction industry, electrical construction industry, not funded this with deferred monies that ultimately would have gone to salaries, this couple would have enjoyed those income streams that weren't deferred into the pension plan. That's why a defined benefit plan, as opposed to a defined contribution plan, is still divided in a marital situation. So the rule is disability benefits are not automatically exempt from consideration. In fact, disability benefits in a lot of cases should be part of the marital estate if they were derived from contributions made during the marriage.
I wonder, counsel, if that proposed rule isn't getting a little far away from the language of the contract or the agreement that the parties signed their names to at the time of the divorce, the marital settlement agreement. The marital settlement agreement here requires references, as has been noted, retirement, pension, and deferred benefit accounts. And the thought that occurs to me as I listen carefully to the arguments of both counsel, how much of this case and how much of the argument is dependent upon the coincidence that the husband continued working for the same employer? This is a fairly generous disability and retirement package as these things go these days. I'm trying to resolve the contract language with the coincidence that he chose to continue working in such a fashion that allowed him to collect disability. For instance, if his employer didn't have such a provision for disability, and he would have been dependent, as so many Americans are, perhaps on Social Security disability, but then had the potential to get retirement at age 62 or 65, her potential payment of $912 and change a month would not be diminished by his receipt of the disability, but would in fact have to wait until either 62 or 65 when he elected. I wonder if you can help me with that, because it does seem somewhat dependent on a coincidence of him choosing to remain with this employer and also the fact of the generosity of this package.
First of all, one of the things that I think is important to note is that Mr. Topolsky was receiving Social Security disability as well. He did receive, and I believe he testified that at the time of the hearing in 2009.
I think you made reference, or someone made reference to that earlier, but my hypothetical had it that would be the sole source.
Your Honor, and I understand your concern. What I'm getting at is that in my view of this case, the parties had choices to make at the time of their divorce, and they made those choices, and they divided this asset the way that they divided it. It is an asset. It's one pension plan. It has your ability to exercise that pension plan is based on certain criteria.
But you keep saying this pension plan as if it's directly related to the plan that we happen to be reviewing today. I look at the language of the marital settlement agreement. I see all retirement, pension, and deferred benefit accounts. I see no obligation on his part to continue to remain eligible for any particular pension plan.
It you look at the summary plan description, Mr. Topolsky's benefits were set at that point in time, meaning that even if he had stopped working for that employer and went on to some other endeavor, if he started to exercise those benefits, he would have had them. He was vested at that time, okay? And so, therefore, whether he chooses to go to a different employer or not.
Was he vested at those amounts, though, $2,300 a month?
That I don't know, and the only thing I can surmise.
I suspect common practice would be it would be substantially less.
I would imagine, and in my best guess, if you want me to guess, is that the pension that he had accrued at that point in time was $1,824, because one half of that is
sounds like the most specific guess I've heard this week.
Well, I say that
if it's not in the record, it's unfair. I thought you were literally going to get. If it's not in the record, I don't want to.
He's just doubling.
Doubling the amount that was awarded to Mrs. Topolsky. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Was there any other questions? Thank you, counsel. I want to thank you, Mr. Schneck, and Mr. Owens for dealing with a domestic relations case. We haven't had one for a while, and I'm sure this one will be very helpful to everybody. And so we end our hearing in 09-AP-2433-FT, Patrick Topolsky versus Ellen J. Topolsky. The students may leave. Kevin Pond will help you out if you need any assistance. And the court will meet in the conference room at 3:25. We are in recess until tomorrow at 9:45.